Chapter 33. The Book is Written. From our position in the lounge of the Penderyn Hotel, we could see Thursday's good work. The narrative continued rapidly. Weeks passed in the space of a few lines. As the words wrote themselves back across the page, they were read aloud by Mycroft or myself. We were all waiting for the phrase, "sweet madness," to appear in the text, but it didn't. We prepared ourselves to assume the worst, that Hades was not caught, and might never be, that Thursday might stay in the book as some sort of permanent caretaker. From Bowden Cable's journal. The weeks passed rapidly at Thornfield, and I busied myself with the task of making Jane secure without her ever knowing it. I had a young lad positioned at the Millcote to warn of Hades' movements, but he seemed quite happy just to go out walking every morning, borrow books from the local doctor, and spend his time at the inn. His inaction was a cause of some worry, but I was glad it was merely that for the time being. Rochester had sent a note advising of his return, and a party was arranged for local friends of his. Jane seemed to be severely agitated by the arrival of the airhead Blanche Ingram, but I gave it little heed. I was busy trying to arrange security with John, the cook's husband, who was a resourceful and intelligent man. I had taught him to shoot with Rochester's pistols, and he was, I was delighted to find out, an excellent shot. I had thought that Hades might make an appearance with one of the guests, but, apart from the arrival of Mr. Mason from the West Indies, nothing out of the ordinary occurred. The weeks turned into months, and I saw little of Jane, on purpose, of course, but kept in contact with the household and Mr. Rochester to make sure that all was going well. And it appeared that all was going well. As usual, Mr. Mason was bitten by his mad sister in the upper room. I was standing outside the locked door when Rochester went for the doctor, and Jane tended to Mason's wounds. When the doctor arrived, I kept watch in the arbour outside, where I knew Jane and Rochester would meet. And so it went on until a brief respite, when Jane went away to visit her dying aunt in Gateshead. Rochester had decided to marry Blanche Ingram by this time, and things had been slightly tense between him and Jane. I felt some relief that she was away. I could relax and talk to Rochester quite easily, without Jane suspecting anything.
"You aren't sleeping," observed Rochester, as we walked together on the front lawn. "Look how your eyes are dark-rimmed and languorous."
"I don't sleep well here, not while Hades is barely 5 miles distant."
"Your spies surely would alert you to any movement of his."
It was true. The network worked well, although not without some considerable expenditure on Rochester's part. If Hades set off anywhere, I knew about it within 2 minutes, from a rider who stood by for just such an occasion. It was in this manner that I was able to find him when he was out, either walking or reading, or beating peasants with his stick. He had never come within a mile of the house, and I was happy to keep it that way. My spies afford me peace of mind, but I still can't believe that Hades could be so passive. It chills and worries me. We walked on for a while, Rochester pointing out places of interest to me around the grounds, but I was not listening. "How did you come to me that night outside the warehouse where I was shot?" Rochester stopped and looked at me.
"It just happened, Miss Next. I can't explain it any more than you can explain arriving here when you were a little girl. Apart from Mrs. Nakajima and a traveller named Foyle, I don't know of anyone else who has done it."
I was surprised at this. "You have met Mrs. Nakajima, then?"
"Of course. I usually do tours of Thornfield for her guests when Jane is up at Gateshead. It carries no risk and is extremely lucrative. Country houses are not cheap to run, Miss Next, even in this century."
I allowed myself a smile. I thought that Mrs. Nakajima must be making a very sizable profit. It was, after all, the ultimate trip for a Bronte fan, and there were plenty of those in Japan.
"What will you do after this?"
asked Rochester, pointing out a rabbit to Pilot, who barked and ran off. Back to spec ops work, I guess, I replied. What about you? Rochester looked at me broodingly, his eyebrows furrowed and a look of anger rising across his features.
There is nothing for me after Jane leaves with that slimy and pathetic excuse for a vertebrate, St. John Rivers.
So what will you do?
Do? I won't do anything. Existence pretty much ceases for me about then.
Death?
Not as such, replied Rochester, choosing his words carefully. Where you come from, you are born, you live, and then you die. Am I correct?
More or less.
A pretty poor way of living, I should imagine, laughed Rochester. And you rely upon that inward eye we call a memory to sustain yourself in times of depression, I suppose.
Most of the time, I replied, although memory is but 1/100th of the strength of currently felt emotions.
I concur. Here, I neither am born nor die. I come into being at the age of 38 and wink out again soon after, having fallen in love for the first time in my life and then lost the object of my adoration, my being.
He stopped and picked up the stick that Pilate had considerately brought him in place of the rabbit he couldn't catch.
You see, I can move myself to anywhere in the book I wish at a moment's notice, and back again at will. The greatest parts of my life lie between the time I profess my true love to that fine, impish girl, and the moment the lawyer and that fool Mason turn up to spoil my wedding and reveal the madwoman in the attic. Those are the weeks to which I return most often. But I go to the bad times, too. For without a yardstick, sometimes the high points can be taken for granted. Sometimes I muse that I might have John stop them at the church gate and stall them until the wedding is over. But it is against the way of things.
So while I am talking to you here...
I am also meeting Jane for the first time, wooing her, then losing her forever. I can even see you now, as a small child, your expression of fear under the hooves of my horse.
He felt his elbow.
And feel the pain of the fall, too. So you see, my existence, although limited, is not without benefits.
I sighed. If only life were that simple. If one could jump to the good parts and flick through the bad.
You have a man you love?
Asked Rochester suddenly. Yes, but there is much bad air between us. He accused my brother of a crime that I thought unfair to lay upon the shoulders of a dead man. My brother never had a chance to defend himself, and the evidence was not strong. I find it hard to forgive.
What is there to forgive? Demanded Rochester. Ignore forgive, and concentrate on living. Life for you is short. Far too short to allow small jealousies to infringe on the happiness which can be yours only for the briefest of times.
Alas, I countered, he is engaged to be married.
And what of that? Scoffed Rochester. Probably to someone as unsuitable for him as Blanche Ingram is for me.
I thought about Daisy Mutler, and there did, indeed, seem to be a strong similarity. We walked along together in silence until Rochester pulled out a pocket watch and consulted it.
My Jane is returning from Gateshead as we speak. Where is my pencil and notebook?
He rummaged within his jacket and produced a bound drawing book and a pencil.
I am to meet her as if by accident. She walks across the fields shortly in this direction. How do I look?
I straightened his necktie and nodded my satisfaction.
Do you think me handsome, Miss Next?
He asked quite suddenly. No, I answered truthfully.
Bah! Exclaimed Rochester. Pixies both! Begone with you! We will talk later.
I left them to it and walked back to the house by way of the lake, deep in thought. And so the weeks wore on. the air becoming warmer and the buds starting to shoot on the trees. I hardly saw anything of Rochester or Jane, as they had eyes only for each other. Mrs. Fairfax was not highly impressed by the union, but I told her not to be so unreasonable. She flustered like an old hen at this remark and went about her business. The routine of Thornfield didn't waver from normalcy for the next few months. The season moved into summer, and I was there on the day of the wedding, invited specifically by Rochester and hidden in the vestry. I saw the clergyman, a large man named Mr. Wood, ask whether anyone knew of an impediment that might prevent the wedding being lawful or joined by God. I heard the solicitor call out his terrible secret. Rochester, I could see, was beside himself with rage, as Briggs read out the affidavit from Mason to declare that the madwoman was Bertha Rochester, Mason's sister, and Rochester's legal wife. I remained in hiding as the argument ensued, emerging only when the small group was led over to the house by Rochester to meet his mad wife. I didn't follow. I went for a walk, breathing in the fresh air and avoiding the sadness and anguish in the house as Rochester and Jane realized they could not marry. By the following day, Jane was gone. I followed at a safe distance to see her take the road to Whitcross, looking like a small stray searching for a better life elsewhere. I watched her until she was out of sight, and then walked into Millcote for lunch. Once I had finished my meal at the George, I played cards with three travelling gamblers. By supper time, I had taken 6 guineas off them. As I played, a small boy appeared at our table. "Hello, William," I said. "What news?" I bent down to the height of the waif, who was dressed in adult-sized hand-me-downs that had been sewn up to fit.
"Begging your pardon, Miss Next, but Mr. Hedge has vanished."
I leaped up in some alarm, broke into a run, and didn't stop until I arrived at the Millcote. I flew upstairs to the landing, where one of my most trusted spies was tugging at his flat cap nervously. Hades' room was empty.
"I'm sorry, miss. I was in the bar downstairs. Not drinking, mind. I swear to it. He must have slipped past me. Did anyone else come down the stairs, Daniel? Tell me, quick." "No one. No one save the old lady."
I took the horse from one of my riders and was at Thornfield in double quick time. Neither of the guards at the doors had seen anything of Hades. I entered and found Edward in the morning room, toasting himself from a bottle of brandy. He raised his glass as I entered.
"She's gone, hasn't she?" he asked.
"She has."
"Damnation! Curse the circumstances that allowed me to be trapped into the wedding with that half-wit, and curse my brother and father for entreating such a union!"
He fell into a chair and stared at the floor.
"Your work is done here?"
he asked me resignedly. "I think so, yes. I have only to find Hades, and I can be off."
"Is he not at the Millcote?"
"Not any longer."
"But you expect to capture him?"
"I do. He seems weakened here."
"Then you had better tell me your password. Time may not be on our side when the moment comes. Forewarned is forearmed."
"True," I conceded. "To open the portal, you have to say..." But at that moment, the front door slammed. A gust of wind disturbed some papers, and a familiar footfall rang out on the tiles in the hall. I froze and looked across at Rochester, who was staring into his glass.
"The code word?"
Heard a voice calling to Pilate. It had the deep bass resonance of the master of the house.
"Blast!" murmured Hades,
as he melted from his disguise as Rochester and leaped at the wall in a flash, bursting through the lath and plaster as though it were rice paper. By the time I had made my way to the hallway outside, he had gone, vanished somewhere deep into the house. Rochester joined me as I listened intently up the stairs, but no sound reached us. Edward guessed what had happened and quickly mustered his estate workers. Within 20 minutes, he had them guarding the outside of the house, under strict orders to fire upon anyone who tried to escape without giving a prearranged password. This done, we returned to the library, and Rochester drew out a set of pistols and loaded each carefully. He looked uneasily at my Browning automatic as he placed two percussion caps atop the nipples of the pistols and replaced the hammers. "Bullets just make him mad," I told him.
"You have a better idea?"
I said nothing.
"Then you had better follow me. The sooner this menace is out of my book, the better."
All except Grace Poole and the madwoman had been removed from the house, and Mrs. Poole had been entreated not to open the door to anyone until the morning on any account, not even to Mr. Rochester. Rochester and I started at the library and moved through to the dining room, and then the afternoon reception room. After this, we searched the morning reception room and then the ballroom. All were empty. We returned to the staircase where we had placed John and Matthew, who both swore no one had passed them. Night had descended by this time. The men who stood guard had been given torches, and their meagre light flickered in the hall. The stairs and panelling of the house were of a dark wood, which reflected light poorly. The belly of a whale would have been brighter. We reached the top of the stairs and looked left and right, but the house was dark, and I cursed myself for not bringing a good flashlight. As if in answer to my thoughts, a gust of wind blew out the candles, and somewhere ahead a door banged. My heart missed a beat, and Rochester muttered an oath as he stumbled into an oak chest. I quickly relit the candelabrum. In the warm glow, we could see each other's timorous faces, and Rochester, realizing that my face was a reflection of his own, steeled himself to the task ahead and shouted,
"Coward! Show yourself!"
There was a loud concussion and a bright orange flash as Rochester fired off a shot in the direction of the staircase leading to the upper rooms.
"There! There he goes, like a rabbit! I fancy I winged him too."
We hurried to the spot, but there was no blood, merely the heavy lead ball embedded in the banister rail.
"We have him!" exclaimed Rochester. "There is no escape from up here except the roof, and no way down without risking his neck on the guttering."
We climbed the stairs and found ourselves in the upper corridor. The windows were larger up here, but even so the interior was still insufferably gloomy. We stopped abruptly. Halfway down the corridor, standing in the shadows, and with his face lit by the light of a single candle, was Hades. Running and hiding were not his style at all. He was holding the lighted candle close to a rolled-up piece of paper that I knew could only be the Wordsworth poem in which my aunt was imprisoned.
"The code word, if you will, Miss Next."
"Never!" He placed the candle closer to the paper and smiled at me.
"The code word, please."
But his smile became an expression of agony. He let out a wild cry, and the candle and poem fell to the ground. He turned slowly to reveal the cause of his pain. There, on his back, and clinging on with grim determination, was Mrs. Rochester, the madwoman from Jamaica. She cackled maniacally and twisted a pair of scissors that she had buried between Hades' shoulder blades. He cried out once again and fell to his knees as the flame from the lit candle set fire to the layers of wax polish that had built up on a bureau. The flames greedily enveloped the piece of furniture, and Rochester pulled some curtains down in order to smother them. But Hades was up again, his strength renewed. The scissors had been withdrawn. He swiped at Rochester and caught him on the chin. Edward reeled and fell heavily to the floor. A manic glee seemed to overcome Acheron as he took a spirit lamp from the sideboard and hurled it to the end of the corridor. It burst into flames and ignited some wall hangings. He turned on the madwoman, who went for him in a blur of flailing limbs. She deftly whipped Mycroft's battered instruction booklet from Hades' pocket, gave a demonic and triumphant cry, and then ran off. "Yield, Hades!" I yelled, firing off two shots. Acheron staggered with the force of the slugs, but recovered quickly and ran after Bertha and the book. I picked up the precious poem and coughed in the thick smoke that had started to fill the corridor. The drapes were now well alight. I dragged Rochester to his feet. We ran after Hades, noticing as we did so that other fires had been started by Acheron in his pursuit of the instruction manual and the insane Creole. We caught up with them in a large back bedroom. It seemed as good a moment as any to open the portal. Already the bed was ablaze, and Hades and Bertha were playing a bizarre game of cat and mouse, with her holding the booklet and brandishing the scissors at him, something he seemed to be genuinely fearful of. "Say the words," I said to Rochester.
"And they are?"
"Sweet madness." Rochester yelled them. "Nothing." He yelled them even louder. "Still nothing." I had made a mistake. Jane Eyre was written in the first-person narrative. Whatever was being read by Bowden and Mycroft back home was what Jane was experiencing. Anything that happened to us didn't appear in the book, and never would. I hadn't thought of this.
"Now what?" asked Rochester.
"I don't know. Look out!" Bertha made a wild lunge at us both and ran out of the door, swiftly followed by Hades, who was so intent on regaining the instruction manual that the two of us seemed to be of secondary importance. We followed them down the corridor, but the stairwell was now a wall of flame, and the heat and smoke pushed us back. Coughing and with eyes streaming, Bertha escaped onto the roof with Hades, myself and Rochester not far behind. The cool air was welcome after the smoky interior of Thornfield. Bertha led us all down onto the lead roof of the ballroom. We could see that the fire had spread downstairs, the heavily polished furniture and floors giving the hungry flames plenty of nourishment. Within a few minutes, the large and tinder-dry house would be an inferno. The madwoman was dancing a languid dance in her nightclothes, a dim memory, perhaps, from the time when she was a lady, and a far cry from the sad and pathetic existence she now endured. She growled like a caged animal and threatened Hades with the scissors as he cursed and entreated the return of the booklet, which she waved at him in a mocking fashion. Rochester and I watched, the shattering of windows and the crackle of the fire punctuating the silence of the night. Rochester, annoyed at having nothing to do and tiring of watching his wife and Hades dance the dance macabre, loosed off the second pistol and hit Hades in the small of the back. Hades turned, unhurt but enraged. He drew his own gun and fired several shots in return as Rochester and I leaped behind a chimney stack. Bertha took full advantage of the opportunity and plunged the scissors deep into Hades' arm. He yelled in pain and terror and dropped his gun. Bertha danced happily around him, cackling wildly as Hades fell to his knees. A groan made me turn. One of Acheron's shots had passed straight through Rochester's palm. He pulled out his handkerchief, and I helped him wrap it around his shattered hand. I looked up again as Hades knocked the scissors from his arm. They flew through the air and landed close by. Powerful again, and as angry as a lion, he leaped upon Bertha, held her tightly by the throat, and retrieved the booklet. He then picked her up and held her high above his head, she all the while uttering a demented yell that managed to drown out the sound of the fire. For a moment, they were silhouetted against the flames that even now licked up against the night sky. Then Hades took two quick steps to the parapet and threw Bertha over, her yell only silenced by the dull thud as she hit the ground three stories below. He stepped back from the parapet and turned to us with eyes blazing.
"Sweet madness, eh?" he laughed. "Jane is with her cousins. The narrative is with her. And I have the manual."
He waved it at me, deposited it in his pocket, and picked up his gun.
"Who's first?"
I fired, but Hades clapped his open hand on the approaching bullet. He opened his fist, The slug was flattened into a small lead disc. He smiled, and a shower of sparks flew up behind him. I fired again, and he caught the slug once more. The slide on my automatic parked itself in the rearward position, empty and ready for the next clip. I had one, but I didn't think it would make much difference. The inevitable presented itself. I'd had a good run, survived him more than any other living person, and done all that was humanly possible. But luck doesn't always walk in your favor. Mine had just run out. Hades smiled at me.
Timing is everything, Miss Next. I have the password, the manual, and the upper hand. The waiting game, as you can see, paid off.
He looked at me with a triumphant expression.
It may come as some consolation that I plan to bestow upon you the honor of being Felix Nine. I will remember you always as my greatest adversary. I salute you for it. And you were right. You never did negotiate.
I wasn't listening. I was thinking about Tamworth, Snood, and the rest of Hades' victims. I looked across at Rochester, who was cradling his blood-soaked hand. The fight had gone out of him.
The Crimea will make us a fortune, went on Hades. How much profit can we make on each plasma rifle? £500? £1,000? £10,000?
I thought of my brother in the Crimea. He had called for me to come back for him, but I never did. My APC was hit by an artillery shell as I returned. I had to be forcibly restrained from taking another vehicle and returning to the battlefield. I never saw him again. I had never forgiven myself for leaving him. Hades was still rambling, and I found myself almost wishing that he'd get on with it. Death, after all I had been through, suddenly seemed like a very comfortable option. At the height of any battle, some say that there is a quietness where one can think calmly and easily, the trauma of the surroundings screened off by the heavy curtain of shock. I was about to die, and only one seemingly banal question came to mind. Why on earth did Bertha's scissors have such a detrimental effect on Hades? I looked up at Acheron, who was mouthing words that I could not hear. I stood up, and he fired. He was merely playing with me, and the bullet flew wide. I didn't even blink. The scissors were the key. He had been made of silver. I reached into my trouser pocket for the silver bullet that Spike had given me. Acheron, vain and arrogant, was wasting time with pompous self-congratulation. He would pay dearly for the error. I slipped the shiny slug into my automatic and released the slide. It chambered the around smoothly. I aimed, pulled the trigger, and saw something pluck at his chest. For a moment, nothing happened. Then Acheron stopped talking and put his hand to where the round had hit home. He brought his fingers up to his face and looked at them with shocked surprise. He was used to having blood on his hands, but never his own. He turned to me, started to say something, but then staggered for a moment before pitching heavily forward onto his face and moving no more. Acheron Hades, third most evil man on the planet, was finally dead, killed on the roof of Thornfield Hall, and mourned by no one. There was little time to ponder Hades' demise. The flames were growing higher. I took Mycroft's manual and then pulled Rochester to his feet. We made our way to the parapet. The roof had grown hot, and we could feel the beams beneath our feet starting to flex and buckle, causing the lead roof to ripple as though it were alive. We looked over, but there was no way down. Rochester grasped my hand and ran along the roof to another window. He smashed it open, and a blast of hot air made us duck.
"Servants' staircase," he coughed. "This way."
Rochester knew the way through the dark and smoky corridor by feel, and I followed him obediently, clutching his jacket tails to stop myself getting lost. We arrived at the top of the servants' staircase. The fire didn't seem to be as strong here, and Rochester led me down the steps. We were halfway down when a fireball flared up in the kitchen and sent a mass of fire and hot gases through the corridor and up the staircase. I saw a huge red glow erupt in front of me as the stairway gave way beneath us. After that, blackness.